This is The Public Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. Butler Hospital announced plans this week to replace the roughly 800 unionized workers that have been striking for the past few weeks. We'll hear about how we got here and why it might not be so easy to fill those roles. Also, it's hurricane season, and although New England rarely takes a direct hit, emergency officials want residents to remember the basics needed to get through a storm. We'll share some of those tips. And summer festival season is upon us. Get ready to take notes. Today on Artscape, we'll tell you about some of the many opportunities for music, food, and fun, starting with this weekend's Providence Porch Fest. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. Nurses, mental health workers, and other employees at Butler Hospital in Providence have been striking since mid-May after negotiations over a new contract stalled with the company that runs the hospital. Earlier this week, the hospital announced plans to hire permanent replacements for the roughly 800 unionized workers. Health reporter Lynn Arditti joins me now to tell us more. Lynn, great to have you back.
Thanks, Louis.
So, Lynn, what's been going on? What's the latest news here?
Well, we're now in the third week of the strike by the Butler Hospital workers, and they have lost their company health insurance as of the end of the month, and the union says hundreds of them have applied for benefits on the state's health exchange. And the two sides have brought in federal mediators who are now helping to try to facilitate some type of an agreement. Butler's hospital management this week let the workers know that they plan to hire permanent replacements for the striking workers. They've already spent over $3 million, according to the hospital's president, on temporary workers. These are people who fly in from other states and carry a very high hourly rate to keep the hospital running during the strike.
Why are the workers striking exactly?
Well, a number of issues. Some of them are pretty basic economic issues, wages. Members of the Service Employees International Union, 1199 New England, say they want better wages for all their workers, but especially for the lowest wage workers, like people in the dietary staff, people who work in the cafeteria, whose wages start at $16 an hour. And, you know, a quick Google search will show that shift leaders at Chick-fil-A, I think it's called Chick-fil-A, pay up to $19 or $21 an hour. So these are really low-wage workers. Another big issue is the pension plan. Butler Hospital employees who are unionized have been receiving a defined benefit pension plan. These are traditional pensions, unlike 401ks or what we call 403bs that pay based on your investments in stocks. And Butler wants to stop offering those for new hires. And basically, the union says many of our employees are making less than $50,000 a year. They are living paycheck to paycheck, and they just can't afford to contribute to a plan like a 401k, and they deserve a retirement that is secure. And so they're fighting to keep those defined benefit pension plans for all their workers, not just the current ones. The other big issue is workplace safety. And you've seen an increase in injuries of workers on the job at hospitals. This is not just at Butler. This is, you know, nationwide. There's been a heightened sort of tension at hospitals. I think this probably started during COVID or post-COVID. And the workers say that that they haven't been given the sort of rights that they want in terms of negotiating on the basis of how to make the hospital a safer place. Butler administrators say they're committed to making the workplace safe. It's very important to them. So those are some of the issues that are the two sides are at loggerheads.
So you take those issues, the staff shortages, you know, the dangers at work, and of course this strike. And I'm just wondering, how is this affecting the care that the people are receiving?
Well, I wish I had more insight into that. The hospital's president and COO, Mary Maron, has said repeatedly that the hospital is still operating as usual and caring for all its patients and providing all the services that they normally do. But she's also stressed many times that she wants the striking workers to return to work. So it remains to be seen how it affects the hospital internally. I wish I had more insight. You know, I'm sure it's difficult. New workers coming in from out of town and having to be trained to work at a hospital where they're unfamiliar with the process has got to be a big strain on the hospital and the other staff. They say that they're operating as usual.
What's happening at Butler isn't unique, but this comes at a time when the state's healthcare system is overwhelmed. The workforce shortages, the major shortage of primary care providers. Lynn, help us put what's happening at Butler in the broader context.
Yeah, well, for some numbers, you know, last year there were 36 strikes around the country in the healthcare and social assistance industry. So far this year, we're 6 months in, and there are at least 12 other healthcare strikes, according to this labor tracker that I looked at, not including Butler Hospital. So 6 months into the year, we're at about 13. Most of the strikes, interestingly, have lasted 7 days or less. This is an open-ended strike at Butler. There is no date. They have not said it's going to be a two or three. They're saying that they're going to strike until they win, as Jesse Martin, their leader, said. And that's a different kind of strike than many of the strikes we're seeing around the country. Interestingly, in Minnesota and Iowa, the SEIU, the same union, led the nurses and other staff at nursing homes there in a strike that lasted 46 days. And it finally ended in January when the union ratified a tentative agreement. So it remains to be seen how long this one will last, but it does not sound like we are anywhere near the end yet.
Lynn, what's happening next?
Well, I mean, the union seems to be dug in for a long fight, and it looks like the hospital is too. Some workers have reportedly crossed picket lines. We've seen some reports on social media, but we don't know how many of them. Neither side will say how many. It remains to be seen whether this is, you know, a very small percentage or whether this could really affect the unity of the strikers. One thing that's important to remember is that replacing these striking workers is going to be tough because here we are in a staffing shortage already, and now you're trying to find other healthcare workers who are willing to cross a picket line to go to work for Butler. And that's hard to do. Listen to what Howard DeLude, he's interim president of the Hospital Association of Rhode Island. It's the hospital industry trade group. Here's what he had to say.
When we look at wage rates in Massachusetts and Connecticut versus Rhode Island, the rates in Massachusetts and Connecticut can be 20 to 30% higher.
So that tells you that hiring replacements is harder than it sounds. So I think it's going to be a challenge for the hospital going forward.
I've been speaking with health reporter Lynn Arditti. Lynn, I always appreciate the insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Publix Radio. I'm Lewis Hernandez. You're listening to the Weekly Catch. Our political reporter, Ian Donis, joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, it's always a pleasure.
Hey, Lewis.
All right, you broke the news that the Trump administration is investigating Rhode Island. What is this about?
Attorney General Peter Noronha was notified Wednesday that this probe has started. The question is whether patterns and practices regarding employment in state government in Rhode Island violated the Civil Rights Act. That might sound serious. Noronha is not putting a lot of stock in this at this point. He suspects it's part of the Trump administration's effort to quash DEI programs. And he points to a lack of specificity in the notification letter from the Department of Justice. He says if and when there are more details about what the Justice Department is talking about, he'll respond in kind.
A Rhode Island legislative committee this week approved a bill that would ban new sales of guns defined as assault weapons. Supporters have been trying to get this to happen for years. What changed, and where does this issue go from here?
For a long time, there was a big cohort of pro-gun Democrats in the House of Representatives that precluded this kind of vote in the past. That's changed over time as the legislature has moved a little bit to the left. But the money question is really the Senate Judiciary Committee and what happens there and whether there was some kind of covert deal made by the new Senate leadership to try and kill this bill. We'll have a clear read on that by the end of the legislative session. But right now, the House of Representatives is fully behind this bill.
All right. Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee this week removed any doubts about whether he plans to seek re-election next year. Tell us about it.
The governor staffed up his campaign with the deputy campaign manager from New York Governor Kathy Hochul's previous run for governor and a new finance director, someone who's worked in Democratic politics in Rhode Island. There had been a bit of a shadow of a doubt about whether McKee was indeed going to seek re-election next year, and recent poll ratings have not been very good for him. But McKee has shown an ability to squeak through in tight elections. He seems to like running with a chip on his shoulder. And we're looking at an exciting election year. Helena Foulkes almost beat McKee last time. She is in the race, and we're all waiting and watching to see whether House Speaker Joe Ciccarci jumps in.
A lot of great things to talk about. Ian, always appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column out every Friday at 4 p.m. We are in hurricane season, but how many Rhode Islanders or New Englanders are even thinking about it? It's true, rarely does a storm come this far north, but it has happened. It can happen. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above-normal Atlantic hurricane season. What does the state do to prepare for each season? Well, here to talk about it is Mark Pappas, director of the Rhode Island Emergency Management Agency. Mark, a pleasure.
Pleasure, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
So with NOAA's prediction of a more above average season, how concerned are you when you hear that?
I've got to be honest with you. We really don't put too much stock into the hurricane season outlook. It comes out every single year, and last year was predicted to be well above normal. This year is above normal. But truthfully, we always prepare for worst case. So no matter if it's below average, above average, or average, it only takes one storm to impact Rhode Island, or remnants of a storm, truthfully, to have a big impact on the small state. So we prepare well in advance and always prepare for impact by a tropical storm system.
I know that storms don't come up here as often as I was living in Florida, where they hit a lot, but do you get the sense that Rhode Islanders are prepared every time hurricane season comes around?
I think they are. It happens more frequently than you think it does. I know Florida gets hit quite heavily, as well as, you know, Louisiana, Texas, North Carolina, but storms still make it up this way. We had a pre-landfall presidential disaster declaration a few years back for Hurricane Henri, which actually was just downgraded to a tropical storm from a hurricane as it was approaching Block Island. And, you know, we're pretty good at getting the word out to folks. We run a lot of public service announcements all over TV and radio, and we talk constantly with the municipalities, just getting everybody prepared and getting the mindset that we're in the season. And these things can really impact us.
What do you tell residents about how they should prepare? I mean, I always, again, go back to my childhood growing up in the South. We had to have all of our supplies and have a plan. We had to have a plan. It was always what to do if we had to leave. But what do you tell residents here?
You took my words. You have to talk it through with your family and create a plan and go through it with the family and talk it through. We always advise that plan contain pet actions. So if you have pets, to take care of those and be sure that, you know, all the pets are safe. But, you know, check on your neighbors, check on the elderly, anybody who may need assistance to get out if they need to get out. That's part of the prep involved.
There were upgrades made to the Providence Fox Point hurricane barrier this year. What did they do?
Yeah, so we've been in close contact with the Providence Emergency Management Agency and all those folks down there at Fox Point Hurricane Barrier. They just did a refurb of a lot of the mechanisms that open and close the gates. Some of them were in a little bit of disrepair, but that was all fixed. I think there's just a little bit left to go, but we're assured that if they need to close the gates, they could do so at any time. It's perfectly functional.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of changes to FEMA over the years, and I'm wondering, has anything changed especially with change of administration, as to what they can do or what they're going to do if in case of a storm hitting all the way up here?
That's a really good question. And, you know, just this morning, we got off a call with FEMA Region 1 and FEMA headquarters in D.C., talking through some of the changes that they're going through. Truthfully, don't see a lot. I think on the back end, on recovery, they're not going to have folks going door to door. So we're planning here at EMA to work in volunteer organizations like Rhode Island Chapter of the Red Cross, who are amazing at what they do. They also staff all of our regional shelters. So we have to put folks in there during and after a storm for a while. So we're preparing to plus up in the event FEMA can't do some of those things on the back end, like recovery operations, just in case we need to do more. So we're factoring that into our hurricane prep this year.
Are you concerned at all about, I mean, any cuts that have been made to NOAA as we're entering hurricane season and their ability to track storms, not just predict the hurricane season, but to track storms and to keep us informed?
You know, I don't know NOAA entirety, but I know for sure that the Hurricane Center is staffed well. Dr. Mike Brennan, who's actually a friend of mine, is a director down there. He's plussed up. He gave us a brief out this morning while we were on with FEMA. I don't anticipate any real issues in hurricane prediction, especially if one starts to move towards the United States. I think they've got that down.
As any kind of storm is heading this way, what are some of the big challenges for Rhode Island?
Yeah, that's a good one because, you know, Rhode Island, you know, you have the mainland and the coast, and then you have central Rhode Island, and then you have inland Rhode Island because it's very wooded north and west of the Route 95 corridor. So all of those different geographies play into it. And then you have Aquidneck Island and Block Island not attached to a bridge. So, you know, getting out to them, certainly challenging. We do have plans on how we would do that. It's not easy, but we do have plans for that. And then if something should cause a compromise to one of the bridges, how do we get supplies and equipment over? So how we tackle that is we pre-stage and we have supplies and equipment ready to go. Every city and town in Rhode Island has an emergency management director. They work with us very closely. We're in constant contact with those folks. So it's not just the state having a plan. It's the municipalities having a plan.
All right. Well, we are in hurricane season. You're talking to residents. What do you want to tell them?
Hey, you know what? Safety starts now. You know, we want people to turn on their phone alerts because, you know, if you don't do that, you won't get wireless emergency alerts. All the cities and towns have code red. So a lot of the messaging done by cities and towns is to their citizens is through code red. So keep your alerts on your phone, especially during what might be a storm development. One of the things I always hop on is if we tell you to evacuate, we can't mandate folks to do that. But if the governor says to evacuate, if I'm saying that, listen to us because, you know, we want you to stay safe. We want you to be out of the way of any emergency issues that may pop up with storm surge and whatnot and flooding. So if we say to evacuate, it's a big deal. Better to be safe than sorry.
Mark Papacy is the director of the Rhode Island Emergency Management Agency. Mark, I really appreciate the insight. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Weekly Catch. I'm Lewis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. For this week's show, Artscape editor Mareva Lindo and producer James Baumgartner give us a preview of the summer festival season kicking off this weekend.
I'll start with Providence Porch Fest, which is happening on Saturday on porches across the east side of Providence. People volunteer to let bands play on the front porches of their homes, and then the audience gathers around on the sidewalk and on the street to enjoy the music. Peter Evangelista is one of the event organizers.
This year we've got folk, we've got reggae, we have a Baptist choir singing, we have the Rhode Island Men's Gay Chorus singing at Temple Bethel. There's one location that's all strictly bluegrass. Lots of folk. We have a Hawaiian folk singer. A lot of homegrown bands that play in their basements. Rock and roll. The owner of the Cortland Jazz Club on Federal Hill is bringing in a whole lineup of jazz guys. So there really is a wide variety of musicians.
This is the third year for Porch Fest, and it has grown significantly.
This year, we are at 90 porches and 170 performers. So it has just exploded. I think the fact that Rhode Island being a creative capital really ties in nicely. It's a very musically oriented town, and there's a desire for community events. And this is free and it's family friendly. There's no alcohol involved. And especially in these times when people want to get together and just enjoy music and enjoy the good things in life, that I think that's part of the reason it has exploded.
There are scattered showers predicted for Saturday, so bring an umbrella along with a lawn chair so you can enjoy the performances across the east side. The shows go from noon to 6 p.m. in half-hour slots, and you can see a map and schedule at providenceporchfest.com. So, Mareva, what festivals would you like to highlight?
Well, I'm also really looking forward to Porch Fest and crossing my fingers that it does not rain. There are a few other festivals I'm excited about too, though. Also happening this weekend is the 10th annual Day of Portugal Festival in Fall River, Friday through Sunday. About 45% of the city's population is of Portuguese descent, so this is a pretty big deal there. There are performances all 3 days, including some acts from Portugal, like Nuno Ribeiro and Fernando Pereira. In addition to music, there will also be Portuguese food, of course, as well as a kids' fair with face painting, axe throwing, and more. That's Friday through Sunday at the gates of the City Plaza in Fall River, and it's free to the public. And the 7th annual Juneteenth Festival takes place June 22nd in Providence at Roger Williams Park. Also known as Emancipation Day or Freedom Day, this is, of course, the commemoration of the end of slavery in the United States. It's now a national holiday honored on June 19th, and it became an official state holiday here in Rhode Island last year. There will be food, vendors, and music, with R&B singer Thomas Dyer headlining.
Set the mood right, light a candle in the moonlight on the patio, patio. Got all my favorite. Only thing I want on is the radio, radio. Little Sade can go along.
The Juneteenth Festival is Sunday, June 22nd at the Temple to Music in Roger Williams Park, and it's free to the public. Also, the 50th annual Cape Verdean Independence Festival is July 6th at India Point Park in Providence. There will be live music and traditional cultural performances, Cape Verdean food, family-friendly activities, and some cultural exhibits, including Cape Verdean art, storytelling, and dance. There will also be vendors selling work from local and Cape Verdean artisans. The festival is at India Point Park on July 6th, 12 to 8 p.m. Looking towards the end of the summer, the Rhythm and Roots Festival is happening on Labor Day weekend, August 29th to 31st, returning to Ninegret Park in Charlestown. There's music, food, kids' activities, and you can camp there too. The festival features a wide range of acts. The long-running rock band Little Feet is one of the headliners, and there's also bluegrass band Della May and country rock singer-songwriter Steve Earle. But they always bring great Cajun and Zydeco acts to the state in particular, and this time that includes Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys, Balfa Toujours, and Sun Pie and the Louisiana Sunspots. I've never been to the festival, but it's been on my list, and I've heard so many good things from friends who've been going for years. The Rhythm and Roots Festival is August 29th to 31st at Ninegret Park in Charlestown.
Sounds like a great time. Finally, PVD Fest will be in downtown Providence September 5th and 6th. They'll have musicians, DJs, a mural painting battle, artisans, food trucks, and much more. I went to the announcement event earlier this week where Mayor Brett Smiley said the best way to experience it is by just walking around downtown.
Turn a corner, listen to music that you didn't know you liked, see an artisan making something you didn't know you needed, and eat a meal that you didn't know you were craving. That's the way to do PVD Fest.
One of the highlights from PVD Fest every year is a big spectacle performance. This year, it's a show called Brouhaha, performed by Pittsburgh-based multimedia ensemble Squonk. Here's Kathleen Pletcher from FirstWorks, the producing partner of PVD Fest.
At the center of Brouhaha is the Squonk accordion, an enormous audience-powered musical instrument topped with giant tuba bells. The show crescendos as festival-goers inflate this behemoth that echoes throughout downtown and summon a 30-foot puppet head, blinking, smoking, and delightfully alive.
There are these giant bellows that the audience pumps up and down. It looks like a lot of fun. Joe Wilson Jr. is the director of art, culture, and tourism for Providence. He said that last year's festival had over 75,000 attendees and generated $3 million in economic impact for the city. But the intangible benefits were even more important.
When we have an opportunity to gather people in public space across socioeconomic and racial lines, like the power of that, the power of gathering people in public space for them to feel a sense of ownership and pride in their city, there's power in that. But the idea of being able to take in your city anew, to appreciate your city anew, to slow you down just a little bit, to appreciate the beauty of what we have here in Providence, I can't think of any greater value than that.
I love PVD Fest. It's so great to just walk around and see everyone enjoying the performances and the art, and just the overall vibe of the whole city coming together. I can't wait for September.
Absolutely. It's a must for summer in Providence. And we'll also have a fuller list of festivals happening all throughout the summer up on our website at thepublicsradio.org/artscape.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Mareva.
Thanks, James.
For The Public's Radio, I'm James Baumgartner.
Before we end our show, the Trump administration has formally asked Congress to rescind already approved funds for public media across the country. For us, that means losing about 10% of our budget. If you value The Weekly Catch and everything you hear on The Public's Radio, now's the time to show your support. You could do that by making a financial donation, talking with your friends about what public media means to you, and posting on social media with the hashtag #StandShareSupport. You can learn about more ways to take action at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of The Public's Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor is Mareva Lindo. Our chief content officer, Sally Isley, and our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.